Welcome to Dish the Dirt, a light-hearted and fun podcast about Australian flower growers, their stories, knowledge and insights into the industry. I'm your host Rebecca, and each week I speak to a different farmer and get them to dish the dirt. Dish the Dirt acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which we work and live, and recognise their continuing connection to land, water and community. We pay respect to elders past, present and emerging. Hello and welcome to this very special episode of Dish the Dirt. It's a bonus episode before we get into season 6, which begins next week on June the 17th. I was lucky enough to have the opportunity to speak to best-selling author Maya Linnell, and we chat about her new book, Paperback Hill, her property and love of flowers, her baking, I talk about my eating of baking, and of course, her insights into the flower industry whilst she was researching her book. From country show baking to raising orphaned lambs, best-selling author Maya Linnell writes about the life she lives and loves. A keen bookworm, wannabe flower farmer, and former rural journalist, Maya also hosts a monthly online show called Library Lovers for the digital app Libby Overdrive. She lives in rural Victoria with a menagerie of animals, sweeping gardens, 3 young bookworms, and the odd tiger snake or 3. You can find Maya at Maya Linnell Writes on Instagram or mayalinnell.com. Paperback Hill is available at all good bookstores now, including Kmart, Target, and Big W. It was a pleasure to have Maya on the show. I hope you all enjoy this episode, and let's get into it. How are you? How was your day?
Yeah, really good, thank you. I went across the border over to Mount Gambier and did some bookish things, which is nice.
So, yeah, wow.
Yeah, it's always really neat to go and sign books. You feel like a real author then, and visit libraries and see if they've got their copies yet and hand over posters and promotional stuff. So, yeah, it's a really nice type of day. Thank you.
Yeah, fabulous. So whereabouts are you situated?
So we're in southwest Victoria, and we're only just about an hour from the border. So we're right on the coast, right just next to the SA border. So it's a pretty quiet little spot here.
Yeah, and what's your climate like there? Is it getting cold?
No? It's a bit chilly. I think it's been about 10 degrees today, which is okay. Very
yeah, it's been about 7 or 6 here, so I definitely know that feeling. So I want to chat to you tonight, obviously, about Paperback Hill, but also about your story and sort of your flower journey and what you do on the farm and, you know, how you got into writing and also how you got into growing flowers.
Fabulous. So, that sounds good. I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah. Since I've read Paperback Hill, I'm such a nerd. I'm always like, what would Diana do in this situation? Like tonight I rolled in the door from Evie does ballet first thing in the morning, and then we live in Hillsville, so I have to, everything's a drive from Hillsville. Everything's like 30 or 40 minutes away. So then I come back home, get her done for the day, and then I go and pick Harriet up from school, and then she does tap, jazz, contemporary and ballet on a Tuesday evening. And so then I run in the door like after all of that with Evie normally losing her mind. And tonight I thought, what would Diana do? Diana would have already had dinner on the table. She would have had like a batch of yo-yos made. You are hopeless, Rebecca.
Oh, look, that's the wonderful thing about making fiction characters is that you can make them angelic, you can make them so aspirational. Wonderful.
I love her. So do you want to begin with telling me how you got onto your farm and how you started writing?
Yeah, absolutely. So as I said, we live in southwest Victoria. We've got a really small little rural property. It's 8 acres, and it backs onto the beach. So when we first bought this property in 2014, it was just a bare cow paddock. So it really, it actually had cows in it. It had only a few trees down the bottom of the block, and we kind of own half of a sand dune. So that was all cleared our side of it. So it was just grass.
Yeah.
And we knew that we wanted to build our own house, and we wanted to put on, you know, give our kids the type of lifestyle that we'd both grown up with. I'd grown up on a small 2-acre block. My husband grew up on a farm. We just wanted them to be able to run around and climb trees and pick flowers and stuff. So but the first thing we did once we purchased the property was renovate this little old dairy. And by renovate, I mean we just, you know, braced the walls because they were falling down and replaced the roof. Just so that we could store some stuff in there. And then we planted trees, natives, right up the front because the road is quite close by, and we wanted to try and, I guess, get a bit of a buffer between us and the road. So we put in trees in, I think 2014, just natives. And that was our first bit of planting. And slowly as we built the house, I just added garden after garden after garden. And my husband is really good at helping out as well. Jason, he is very good with the muscles and the labor and lots of the good ideas as well. So
we
did a lot of gardening by tractor, just pushing up big piles of mulch, and people would drop off, you know, ute loads of agapanthus were some of our first things that we put in the ground. And they just grow because it's so close to the coast. We needed stuff that was hardy. So we put in huge, big Wistringia hedges. So that's the coastal rosemary.
Yeah.
Lots of agapanthus, lots of natives. And once we had, I guess, the house structure underway, so we kind of started making all the bricks ourselves. And that was a good, you know, it took 9 months to make all of our bricks. But once we got them up, it felt like, the hard yards are done.
But yeah.
They were just starting. So we got the gardens kind of grew along with the house. And by the time we moved in 5 years ago, we had, you know, relatively established gardens. And the thing I love about our gardens here is a lot of it was pieces from friends. I had my friend Emma's geraniums. I had Marilyn's Gladys. I had Heather's big yuccas and strappy things that she had growing in her garden that they pulled out with the tractor and passed on to us, and we've since pulled out half of them with our tractor because they get
too Yeah, they do, and they take over everything. They become sort of a weed, but anyway.
So they're really good as a sacrificial plant, we call them, because, you know, you're happy to rip them out once they've done their job and allowed some of the more fragile plants to get established.
Yeah.
And we also lucked out because one of our friends back in South Australia was ripping up a huge big rose garden, and it was an ornamental, a beautiful nursery / show garden that people would go and have their wedding photos taken out. And my brother's neighbour bought it, and he hated roses. So he said, I'm just pushing all these roses into a heap. And I knew exactly which property he was talking about because when I used to work as a journalist at the newspaper in town in Millicent, I would go and take photos of them for their, you know, advertising campaigns and stuff. So I was horrified to think that all these beautiful roses that the previous owners had spent so long building these gardens were just being pushed into a heap. So we rescued about 70 roses from that property, and not all of them made it. It's a bit of a translate to kind of, it was the wrong time of year, but we were happy to, you know, try it anyway rather than just
burn it.
And the same with dahlias. We were really lucky in that the botanical gardens in Portland, which is really close to our home here, every time when they're digging them up at the end of the season, they would just leave these big esky boxes at the end of the aisles of the ones that were either broken or damaged, or they've been growing in the wrong spot because they have them all labelled and numbered. And, you know, every now and then some mystery ones would find their way into a patch. So they got turfed out to the end of the aisle. And lucky people like me who happen to be walking around with a pusher and children, you know, would see them throwing these excess unwanted tubers away, and stuck my hand up and said, oh, I'd love some of those. I've never grown dahlias, but I'll give it a shot. And that was probably about 6 years ago. And it's just wonderful because now I have well over 100 dahlias. I've got over 100 roses because I keep adding to them myself. I can't stop collecting.
Yeah, fabulous.
And it's just a really, really nice garden to kind of have created piece by piece with, you know, as much room as we want. We've got about 2 acres of the property is garden. So,
yeah,
you know, if something doesn't work, then we try something new.
And it sounds like it's sort of a typical author garden. Everything has a story to it, if that makes sense. You know, all of your plants sound like they have a backstory and someone that has loved them previously, and they've ended up with you, which is really nice.
Yeah, they certainly do.
Yeah. So going to Paperback Hill, did you, I know on the cover, is that your garden?
It is. That was the loveliest thing. So my publisher, Alan Unwin, this is my fourth book they've put out, and each time the cover usually comes to me as a pretty much finished product, and I just get to say, oh yeah, okay, thanks. And then this time, you know, the last two books, they've started giving me a little bit more leeway. I think you have to kind of earn your stripes as an author before you get, you know, full consultation with these things.
Yeah.
So Ridge, it had a picture of the Grampians because the books are set in the Grampians. So it had a lady's face on the front, which all rural romance novels have. So that's kind of not up for discussion. But the second book had a renovation, an old fixer-upper on the front cover, which is wonderful because the second book, Bottle Brush Creek, is all about a renovation project. Mm. The third book, I got to say, oh, there's this fantastic photographer, Min McCormack, who lives over in the high country near Mount Beauty in Victoria. She takes beautiful photos. You should have a look at hers for a potential cover. And so they did. They chose a beautiful photo by Min McCormack. And then with Paperbark Hill, because the whole story is about a flower farm and the wonderful cover designer from Alan Unwin, her name's Nada, she follows me on Instagram and I follow her because I love seeing how she creates these covers. Anyway, she had been watching one of my particular stories that I did or posts that I did last year with all my dahlias and saying how excited I was about dahlia season. And so she had photoshopped this picture of my garden into the rough draft of the front cover. And my publisher, Annette, said to me, Maya, we've got some cover roughs for you to have a look at in two different backgrounds, see what you think. And, of course, you wait. Like, you, when you spend a year writing a book, you're really eager to see what the front cover looks like and if you're going to hate them or if you're going to like them or if you're going to like the background. And I did one of those Hollywood gasps, like hand over my mouth and a big shriek when I saw that one of the cover roughs, of course, had my garden in there, and the little old dairy that is there in the background. So that was just the most thrilling cover to see. There could have been a chimpanzee on that front cover as well as my garden, and I would have thought it was beautiful.
It is so stunning, and I love how you can see sort of right down to the coastline. Is that the coastline in there?
Yeah,
it is beautiful.
Sand dune at the bottom of our property. So one half of it, the half that's owned, I guess, by the Department of Lands and Environment, that's got trees on it, and it's all cleared up to the top of that.
What do you love about growing flowers?
Well, there's lots of things that I love about flowers. I guess probably one of the biggest things, and it was really reinforced during lockdown, is that flowers are the promise of good things to come. So you know that when you're looking at a tuber of a dahlia and it looks like this ugly, wrinkled potato that, you know, someone's thrown away in the bargain bin at Woolies, you know, that has got so much goodness and sustenance in it. And if you just treat it right, it will bloom into a beautiful flower. And then not only will it do that, but then it will multiply like crazy and give you more reward the following season. So I think that's really nice, the reward that you get. It's a good reminder to be patient, and I'm not always a patient person. I like to see things happening, you know, now, yesterday, you know, 2 weeks ago. But farming or working with flowers really, really makes me have to slow down and appreciate the different seasons for what they are.
Yeah, and I noticed that when you were over lockdown, did you sell some of your flowers? Or did you have a little stall at the front of your property?
We thought we'd do some of that. I think, what was it called? The kindness pandemic. The kids and I, because, you know, here in Victoria, just like you, we spent so long in lockdown. And at the time of the very first lockdown, the dahlias were in full blooms. The cars slowing down and stopping, and you'd see a dad and his child come out and you could just imagine them picking that bunch of flowers for, you know, the mum at home or, you know, for someone special. And they, some people just left lovely notes saying, thank you so much, this has really made my day. And then that made our day. And occasionally we'd be out in the yard and people would pull up and grab some flowers and we'd wave and say, hello, how are you? And some people even left us chocolates, which was just,
we didn't do it for anything,
but it was just the most lovely, lovely reciprocal type of thing that made us smile, it made them smile. And I think flowers are beautiful at doing that.
Yeah. So what made you want to write about flowers and write, I guess, because in the novel you bring up sort of the Australian flower industry a couple of times. What made you want to write about it?
Yeah. So I guess the first thing was because each of the books that I've written so far have been about a different sister in the McIntyre family. Mm. And so in the first book I had Penny, who's returning from the country, from the city back to her country roots. The second book, I've got Angie with that renovation project. The third book, I have the character Lara, who's helping to save the local general store. And then I thought, well, what am I going to do for Diana's story? She's really the mother hen of the family. She looks after her sisters. She takes, you know, strays under her wing. She's a real nurturing person. She's got these four boys of her own as well. And I thought, well, in Bottle Rush Creek, I touched on dahlias and the volunteer commitments that are involved in being part of a committee like the Dahlia Society, even if it's just at a local level.
Mm.
And I really liked having that storyline in there. And I thought, I think there's room to expand on this. And also because I'd said to my husband more than once, hey, honey, we should turn that bottom paddock down there into a flower farm. I've got so many dahlias. I'm giving away bucket loads of tubers every season. We certainly have the tubers. We've got the water because it's a pretty high rainfall area here. Why don't we start a dahlia farm? And he's said, Maya, you have so many wonderful ideas, but remember, you're writing books at the moment and you're contracted for one book a year. So probably best that we don't have another business like a flower farm, which obviously takes a lot of work.
Yeah.
I thought to myself, well, what I can do is I can give my characters that lovely task of starting their own flower farm and I can just live vicariously through Diana McIntyre as she decides to have a crack. When I was trying to plot out the book, I tried to think of different things that would go wrong because, you know, as you and I would both know, if you pick up a book and it's wonderful at the start, it's wonderful at the middle and it's wonderful at the ending, you've not really got a satisfying journey. So I wanted to throw a few things at Diana and see what would happen and how she'd react and what would test her.
Yeah.
The flower farming aspect, you know, went relatively well. There's a few hiccups there, but it's
there
really
is a few.
She tries to juggle the other things in her life that kind of make her choose between the flower farm and her family commitments, as well as a little bit of romance as well. So
yeah, it
was fun to see what you would do.
Which I think is quite prevalent because a lot of the farmers that I speak to tend to be women who have started smaller scale flower farms because they've got a family and it seems like an easy way for them to make some money on the side whilst looking after their families. So I think Diana's story is quite believable in that way because so many people are getting into doing that after having like their family and then not being able to get back into their careers. Is that sort of what you found when you've been researching?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm going to have to put a disclaimer in here, Rebecca, because one of my very favourite research sources was your wonderful podcast, Dish the Dirt.
Thank you.
So when I was researching the book, I completely mainlined this podcast. I listened to so many episodes and just adored the insights into the people that, around the country that are growing these beautiful flowers and doing so well, and listening to them honestly share their stories of the challenges they've come up against as well as the triumphs. It was beautiful and so lovely to see that connection between the beauty of growing flowers and the joy of giving flowers, as well as, you know, that ability to work from that home environment and family, you know, working alongside you as well. So that was definitely one of my favourite bits of inspiration throughout the research process.
Yeah, so what else has sort of inspired you along the way in this book?
Yeah, so there were a couple of key episodes. I'll quickly mention those, because on the podcast, of course, Laura Lee from Florally Flowers near Bungaree was a huge, she was your first guest on the show, and she made a really big impact. And she was very, very kind to read a draft in 2021 and have a look through it just for, relatability and believability, just to make sure it was realistic, the different tasks that I was setting for the characters, what they were doing in a day's work. So that was really, really wonderful. I also spoke with Janae at Flursday Lionsville and brainstormed a couple of ideas with her back in 2020 to, churn out some ideas of what could possibly go wrong with a flower farm. So that was so lovely of her to give me her time to have a bit of a brainstorm session. And then there's also a beautiful little story that I took from Erica at Little House on the Dairy about an Abraham Darby rose. And I probably shouldn't spoil it by telling that story here, but if anyone's listened to that wonderful interview with Erica and you talking about this Abraham Darby rose, it really struck a chord with me and stuck with me throughout the whole second draft. And I thought, I'd love to put that little snippet into the book as something that's really special as to why that particular rose is Diana McIntyre's favourite and the backstory behind it. So I checked with her that she was okay that I put that in, and she was, which was really lovely.
Yeah, great.
And then also other inspirational ladies, Deb Collett from Deb's Dahlias. She's, I think, Red Hill. She lives over near Melbourne Way, and she does some wonderful stuff with the Dahlia Society of Victoria. So she's an inspiration with her beautiful flowers and always doing well at the shows as well.
Yeah.
Eliza Henry-Jones with Gather Flower Farm, which is really cool. And she's an author as well. So she's a very, very clever lady with her flowers. And my mum, Julie, who has been a lifelong gardener, and she's always talking flowers, always very happy to come out every now and then, and, you know, no visit to my house or her house is complete without a stroll around the garden. So she's really good to bounce ideas off and just loves flowers as much as me too.
Yeah, great. They all sound like very amazing ladies, and I do know the first few that you were talking about, and I find them so inspiring as well. So I'm glad that they were able to help you out with little bits and pieces. I love how this book is sort of a showcase for the Australian flower industry as well. Like, I just feel like there's not many books written showcasing what we have in this country, and it really is a bit of a love letter to the industry, I feel. And how do you feel about that? Is that something that you thought of when you were writing it?
Oh, that's lovely. Thank you, Rebecca. It's really nice to hear you say that. Yes, I was really keen. So each book, I try and focus on a few different issues. My publisher in the first draft structural edit stage will say I focus on way too many issues, and we have to weed them out in that structural edit process to really hone in on what my key messages were. And for Paper Bark Hill, because it is set on a flower farm, I really wanted to focus on gardening therapy. So talking about that beauty of nature for healing and dealing with grief, that ability to sink your hands into the soil and to have that hope for good days ahead. So that was one of the key things. I wanted to also talk about addiction and estrangement within families. So that's another one. But then also that grown, not flown movement. I learned so much from listening to the podcast. And it wasn't something that I was extremely aware of beforehand. You know, I'd bought the $5 bouquet of tulips from Aldi thinking, oh, gee, that's cheap. I'll get that and put it on my table. And it wasn't until I started doing my research that I realised that, well, hold on, those tulips have probably been dipped in God knows what chemicals. They've probably flown all the way from the other side of the world because they're completely out of season right now. And how much plastic are they wrapped in? Oh, my goodness. I learned so much about the, you know, lack of country of origin labelling, as well as the packaging and the chemicals. And it really made me want to highlight that in the book. And I'm so pleased that you've noticed that that's something that a message that's trying to get across. Hopefully more people, when they're reading it, they pick it up, they come for a good read and the country charm and the gardening and the baking, and they learn something along the way. Fingers crossed.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. I love how you touch on it in the book. It really, it you know, like I noticed it and I loved it. I thought, what a great way to kind of, you know, get people to notice this sort of thing that's happening in our industry, but in a very lovely, wrapped in a beautiful novel sort of way, instead of being too harsh and saying, you know, you shouldn't do this and you shouldn't do that. It's just lightly putting it in there for everyday thought, which is really great. So do you bake? I need to ask this as well.
I do. I'm a prolific baker. I'm just trying to think of what I've baked this week. I made apple muffins and apple cake last night because our neighbours, it was his birthday, so we took him around at apple cake. We also made, we're at least, you know, a self-sourcing pudding a week generally this time of year. You know, sponge cakes, biscuits, scones, all these things that are regularly going in our oven. I love it. I just can't get enough of
And flour. Is that where Diana got it from? Is it from you? Yeah, great.
Yeah.
Because I have tried to bake more since reading Paperback Hill, to be honest. But I'm eating too much, so it needs to stop. And I feel like Diana was very restrained in her not eating at all, whereas I'm like, oh, I've made some afghans, I'll just eat all of those.
Oh, that's wonderful. I'm so glad to hear, because I feel that people who have read the book say, oh, well, good luck reading it without baking anything by the end. Even if you're not a baker, you know, it will tempt you to kind of have a crack at scones or have a crack at yo-yos or banana cake. And that's lovely. I really love that.
So what do you love the most about your property and your farm?
I think being able to walk around and just admire all the different things that are growing. And, you know, as I said, I just throw so many things in the garden and hope that they grow. And if they don't, then I don't bother with them. And if they do, then I'll collect the seeds and, you know, sow 10 times the amount of them the following year. So I think seeing that reward for hard work paying off, because we're right close to the coast, our soil is so sandy. It is just, you know, the water kind of, it runs through it so quickly. And there's a huge layer of limestone right underneath as well, which is always a bit of a challenge when you're trying to put in fence posts and retaining walls and stuff. So we've had to bring in absolute semi-trailer loads of mulch and stuff like that when friends have been working on a job site clearing out the log yards and things like that. We've stuck our hands up and said, please, if you need to dump anything, come to our place, put it in our paddock as much as you want. You could fill up that whole paddock with mulch and we'd be happy. So when people are chopping down trees on the side of the road, like the tree loppers will stop and say, oh, if you want to drop anything here, you're welcome to.
Great.
Just seeing that what was once that cow paddock that just had grass and the really sandy soil, to build it up and to be continuing to replenish that soil and put organic matter through it, and to see beautiful things growing 400 metres from the coast is the reward, I think, as well as sharing the flowers and making bouquets for friends when it's their birthday, or, you know, if there's been someone ill in the family or if they've lost someone special. I find it personally therapeutic to go out there and try and make a bouquet that might make them smile just for a minute. So it's therapeutic in the actual making of the bouquet, and it's joyous in the giving of the bouquet. And then I'm not an expert at all. Like, my bouquets would probably make any florist frown and shake their head. But, you know, there's that joy in them receiving something that's beautiful and made with love.
Yeah. And where do you think that you'll be sort of in 5 years' time? Do you think that you'll start a dahlia farm in that bottom paddock?
Well, I'm not quite sure about that. I do realise that there's a heck of a lot of work that goes into them. Just trying to keep our 2 acres relatively weed free. There's still plenty of weeds here, there and everywhere. I'm not quite sure whether I would be able to commit to doing a proper dahlia farm, but I certainly will keep adding to my collection. And I've just gotten a whole new appreciation for zinnias. So
so good.
Oh, they're beautiful, and they just seed so lovely. They're happy little givers, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. Well, we'll see a zinnia farm then in 5 years' time. So what has been your biggest learning curve when you have been putting in these dahlias and roses? What have you found the hardest thing?
I think keeping water up to the different plants, because we don't have any special watering systems, it's just me and a hose or a sprinkler, and shifting that sprinkler on the warm days is always quite challenging. And also, because we have really strong winds, coastal, salty, howling winds that come through, sometimes I will go out in the morning after a big storm and just look around and go, oh, well, that's the end of the season then. That's all knocked over. So, yeah, location has been tricky. But I guess one of the really good things about having the sandy soil is it means that I can leave a lot of my dahlias in ground over winter and then just dig them up to divide them and put them straight back in, which is a bit of a treat that I know a lot of people don't have.
Yeah. And what's been the hardest part of writing the book?
Oh, I think the first draft is always really tricky. And I say that because I've just finished the first draft of next year's book, because you're working.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you have to. You have to work a year in advance because there's so much that goes on between the first draft and what actually appears on the shelf a year later. So you have to be quite disciplined. And I always feel with the first draft that I'm back at square one, and I get to the end of it and I understand, oh, that's what I was trying to say. In Paperbark Hill, she has a flower farm and then she meets this guy and, you know.
He's so dreamy. Oh, so dreamy. Is Ned actually your husband?
Oh no. It's funny, the different male characters throughout the book, every one of them I've fallen in love with as I'm writing that male character, and they're all just lovely as I'm writing them. And then I move on to the next book and, oh, he's a dreamboat, that one. But one of the things that I loved about Ned Gardner is that there's so many blokes, particularly old blokes, that just love dahlias, aren't there?
Yeah, there are.
You know, you look at the people that are 80 that have a passion for dahlias, and a lot of them are old men. And so I wrote in Colin Gardner as right at the start of the book, and we hear about him throughout the book. We never actually meet him, and people have to read to find out why. But I really like the idea of having a guy who's got this link to dahlias, as well as being a single dad, and he's got all sorts of things going on, but he was very lovely to write.
Yeah, and he, going back to Colin, he sort of reminded me a lot. There's a man in Victoria called Warren Vigor.
Oh,
I don't know if you've heard of Warren. He's like, I don't know, he's this infamous man to me because I just hear about him through everyone else. So I felt like Colin was very much him in my eyes. I had Warren in my head when I was reading about Colin. I don't know if you've heard of Warren, but anyway.
Yeah, I've actually met Warren at...
Oh, you've met him. Well, there you go.
Yeah. So there's a local show nearby, and I show my dahlias in the beginner's section because I'm just a beginner novice. And I've seen one year he came down to put his beautiful dahlias in. And I tell you what, just the amazing, beautiful flowers in the setup. And he'd driven, I think, from St Arnold. He'd come down a long way just specially to show his dahlias. It's so impressive. So Colin wasn't modelled on him, but I can see what you're talking about there.
Yeah, yeah. So whilst writing this, I know that you sort of touched on the Grown Not Flown movement. Is there anything else that you've, whilst writing the book, that you noticed about the industry that you would love to see change in the future?
I think just that awareness of, yeah, the country of origin labelling and promoting the fact that, you know, we don't necessarily need to use quite as many chemicals. And if you're using chemicals, then often you wipe out all those good bugs that are trying to help out, like the ladybirds and stuff. So I think that's probably a really nice thing to be able to expand upon a bit. I didn't realise that flower foam was a completely evil being until I started researching the podcast either, through the podcast. So I think there's so many cool things that people can learn. I'm certainly not involved enough in the industry to suggest what should change, but I think people learning new things about ways that we can do things better is always a good message to be able to share.
Yeah. And what do you love about this new industry that you've sort of researched and I guess become a part of through writing this book?
I think there's so much generosity within the industry and people that are happy to help out, whether it's by reading drafts or helping you work out if you've got virus in your plants. things like that and where to source different seeds from. I think it's a lovely community that seems very inclusive from my experiences. And I've done some seed swapping as well because, as I mentioned, I just love collecting seeds and having free flowers for next year. So I've done some beautiful seed swaps with some people throughout, you know, the last few years, and it's just really nice to see that, you know, other people get just as excited about, you know, new flowers and new varieties as me.
Yeah. And how did you find people to seed swap with? Was that quite easy?
Yeah. So sometimes I would put it on my Instagram. Oh, look, I've just collected a bucket full of zinnia seeds or seed heads. I'm going to dry these and put them into seeds. And I've done a few giveaways as well through my social media account to promote the book. So when people have pre-ordered, I've done giveaways of you can win a batch of my dahlia seeds, my sunflower seeds, my coriander seeds, sweet peas, jelly bean poppies, all these different types of seeds that I've loved and collected as giveaways. And they've been so popular. It's been really lovely that people might not have won the competition, but then they've said, oh, well, I've got this type of zinnia. Would you like to swap? I say, heck yeah, that sounds great. Or poppies. So there's been some really, really nice friendships just from, you know, seeing their different flowers on their Instagram mostly.
Yeah. Yeah. And lovely. And what would you like to share sort of about the book that I haven't asked you about? Is there anything that you really want people to know about it? Anything, I don't know, that you want to get across that you haven't possibly been asked in any other interview?
I suppose probably talking to people that haven't come across the rural romance genre before. And some people think that rural romance is, you know, really gushy and really over the top, but I like to describe it as MacLeod's Daughters, but in book format. So if you like MacLeod's Daughters, you're probably going to like.
Yeah, I would say that too. I didn't think it was too gushy at all. And I definitely, yeah, I loved it. I just absolutely loved it. Seriously, I'm probably going to read it again. Ask my husband. I couldn't stop reading it. And he would be like, do you want to watch something tonight? I'm like, no, I've got this paperback hill to read. I'm sorry. I've got Ned and I don't need you right now in my life.
Well, that's wonderful. I'm so pleased to hear that because I do feel that there's something really nice about having that escape to the country. There's the baking, there's the gardening, there's the friendships and the close-knit community. So I think it's a really nice place to spend a bit of time with.
Yeah, definitely. And I always ask everyone these questions. So if you had to leave your farm really quickly, what three things would you take with you?
Yes, I love these questions and I always look forward to these at the end of your interviews. I would definitely take the seeds that I've been collecting. So I've got a couple of little containers or boxes with a variety of seeds in there. So my zinnias from this year, my dahlia seeds, my favourite sweet peas and the sunflowers and the coriander that seems to grow anywhere, everywhere, every year. So I definitely take my seeds. There's two of my favourite dahlias that I've been growing for a few years now. There's a beautiful pink and yellow one that's just sensational. It's a semi-decorative. And then I've also got another one. I call it my dinner plate one, but when Deb Collett came around to have a bit of a garden tour this summer, she said, oh, that's not actually dinner plate, Maya. And she showed me the size of the ones that she just won top prize in the Portland show at the Dahlia show of what a dinner plate actually looks like. And they're massive. So mine's probably a bit more like a, you know, the little plate that you get with your coffee cup underneath.
Oh, yeah.
To me, that was so much bigger than all of the rest of the dahlias. I just assumed that was what the dinner plate ones were. So that's a beautiful pink one, and I would certainly keep that. So probably those two dahlias and then my collection of seeds.
Yeah, lovely. And I'm going to flip it now. What would Diana take with her?
Oh, Diana would definitely quickly dig up her Abraham Darby rose because it's so special to her. And then in the story, there's a dahlia seedling that becomes a really special, I guess, representation of the success of the season. So I can't even remember what I end up calling it. I got Laura Lee to help me name that one, and she has a really good suggestion. But because I haven't read it for a few months now, because by the time you get to the book on the shelf, you've already read it 7 times, 8 times, and you're sick to death of it. But then yeah. the problem is you forget some little details like that. So there's a seedling that Diana and Ned named together. So she would definitely take that, I think.
Yeah. And anything else that she would take?
Oh, she did say that she loved the foxgloves as well. So she yeah. probably would try and dig them up as best she could or take some seeds from there.
Yeah, lovely. And what's your favourite tool?
I absolutely love our Atom Edger. So it's a powered petrol-driven edger. Mm. And
sounds
I use it
all nasty.
Oh, it is. So instead of me trying to edge, you know, with a shovel to make that nice gap between where the kikuyu crawls into the garden beds.
Oh, yeah, that stuff.
Oh, this fantastic edger, and it just makes it, you know, eats it like butter. Wonderful.
Yeah, amazing. I need one of those because that grass goes everywhere in my garden, everywhere. Yeah. And it literally the other day we've just had some painting done and the guys chopped a bit of this grevillea out of my garden. So I had to go in and I found this grass and it had crawled up the grevillea. And it was about 3 meters in the air. Like, it was huge. I'm like, how have you gotten so tall? Oh, ridiculous. It just goes everywhere. So I need one of those edges. But what is on your playlist when you're writing? And you don't have to say my podcast. It's totally fine. When you're writing and when you're in the garden.
Well, when I'm writing, I can't listen to podcasts. I have to have music. Well, I don't have to. I either have silence or I like music. And so throughout Paperbark Hill, when I was writing that, I listened to ABC Classic FM. So that was really cool. I loved this is a Scottish presenter who has the morning show, and he is just divine to listen to. I could listen to Russell Torrance presenting ABC Classic every morning. And then different manuscripts, I've listened to different soundtracks. But, yeah, the last two books have been classic FM, and then I had a mixed funky music for Bottle Brush Creek, and then nothing for Wildflower Ridge.
Yeah.
So it's different per book, but when I'm out in the garden, I do love podcasts. So I listen to a lot of writing podcasts, people talking about books, interviewing other authors, learning about the publishing industry, as well as different marketing podcasts. To, I guess, being an author these days, you have to try and play an active role in, you know, having a social media presence and coming up with ideas for giveaways and competitions and stuff. So there's a few little marketing ones that I quite like. There's a really lovely one called Courageous Creatives by a young multi-creative, Georgie Morrison, who lives just down the road here. So that one's really good. I like the Life on the Land podcast from Gracie Herr. There's so many cool podcasts, but of course, Dish the Dirt is always a good one too.
Thank you. And to wrap up, is there anything I haven't asked you that you wanted to share about your farm, the book, anything?
Yeah, well, I definitely say that I've got a giveaway happening for all of the month of June. So it's another of those seed packs that I was talking about. So hand-collected sweet pea seeds, dahlia seeds, sunflower seeds, coriander, jelly bean poppies, zinnias and cosmos, as well as a batch of my own special homemade yo-yo biscuits, which are mentioned quite a few times in the book.
How do I enter?
So all people need to do is post a picture of Paperbark Hill, so whether they're reading it, a digital ebook copy, and they've got it on their iPad, and they take a nice picture in their garden or with their cat or snuggled up on a nice cozy couch, or whether they've got the paperback copy of Paperbark Hill, which gets quite confusing, which is out now in all good bookshops. It's also in Target, Big W, Kmart as well. So a picture of that with their mug of tea or at the beach or on holidays by the pool. So they just need to enter, put a picture up on their social media. There's three hashtags they need to use. One's Paperbark Hill Giveaway. The other one's Maya Linnell, which is me. And the other hashtag is just Paperbark Hill. And if they tag me, then I can see they've entered and I'll draw it at the end of the month.
Yeah, fabulous. How exciting. I'm definitely going to enter this. Well, I need some of those yo-yos.
They're very tasty.
And I just want to quickly ask you, what is your favourite thing to bake?
Oh, it's a tough one. In the winter months, it's probably things like self-sourcing pudding. I did the most gorgeous orange, whiskey and chocolate self-sourcing pudding last weekend. I've made it 3 times now. It is an absolute winner. I never knew that that combination would be so on fire, but it's like eating warm Jaffas.
Yum. Well, when's your cookbook coming out? Because I'm excited for that. Thank you so much for chatting to me. It was a wonderful read and I enjoy following you on Instagram as well. So thank you so much.
No worries. Thank you for having me, Beck, and thanks to all the fantastic listeners who, you know, are also tuning in and thinking about flowers and Grown Not Flown and all these wonderful connections that happen.
Thank you again to Maya for chatting to me about your novel, Paperback Hill. I really enjoyed Paperback Hill, as you can tell in the episode. And like I said, it is out now at all good bookstores. And also you can find it at Kmart, Target and Big W. So no excuses. You can get out there and have a winter romance read. It's really great. Nice bit of escapism. Maya is also running a giveaway on her Instagram page, which is at maya.linnell.writes. You just need to show a photo of you with your copy of Paperback Hill, and you could be in the chance to win a seed collection and also some of her delicious yo-yos. I know that I am entering it, so get along and do that. Next week, like I said, we're kicking off season 6 of Dish the Dirt, and we have some really, really great guests to bring you this season. I can't wait to get into it and share them with you. Until next week, if you could go over to Apple Podcasts and leave me a review, I would love that. You can email me at dishthedirtpodcast@gmail.com, or you can send me a direct message on Instagram. It has been a pleasure to be back with you today. I hope that everyone is staying warm and being blooming fabulous.